Welcome to the Health and Self-Care Podcast. My name is Dr. Andrew Tresidder, a Somerset doctor for quite a number of years and a medical educator, and I'm joined by my colleague and friend,
Dr. Peter Bagshaw, GP and clinical lead for mental health.
And we're really pleased to welcome today Nigel Bell and John Richards, because we're going to talk about the health and care needs of the armed forces community. Nigel and John, could you please introduce yourselves and give a little bit of a backstory about where you've come from and what you've done?
Yep. Good afternoon. I'm Nigel Bell. I am the founder and chief executive of Arkett Egwood. My background is I spent 28 years serving in the Royal Navy. The last 15 years of those as a Royal Naval social worker working in military welfare. I then spent 8 years working in the fostering arena before setting up ARC roughly in 2018, but finally got ARC going in July 2020.
Thank you. And John?
Hi. Yes, I'm John Richards. I also served in the Royal Navy for 24 years. 12 of those working as a Royal Navy social worker in the Royal Navy Royal Marines welfare team. And then I too went to work in fostering with Nigel. Then I did a brief 2-year stint working with a mental health charity in Chard. And then I found myself out here as the Armed Forces lead.
Fantastic. And before we get into ARC and the work that you do and so on, can we just get some definitions clear, please? So we talked about Armed Forces community. Who does that include?
So the armed forces community, from our perspective, includes anyone that is currently serving, a reservist, a veteran, and any member of their family.
Brilliant. That's really clear. So tell us what you do.
So the NHS have commissioned two hubs in Somerset, one here in South Somerset at Arkett Egwood, and the other one in Taunton and West at Victory House. And the hubs are designed to be a focal point for, I guess, a one-stop shop for anyone within the armed forces community. It's hard to pin down what we actually do because the spectrum of things, the issues that we can deal with are quite broad. So ideally, what we are supposed to do is people will contact us, will be referred in by other health professionals, housing officers, village agents, or anybody really. They'll contact us to have a conversation about a problem that they're worried about or a situation that they're stuck in. And then we can work with the individual to kind of work towards resolving that. And we remain the focal point or the one point of contact for that person. So they're not talking to 7 or 8 different people. We're kind of working with that with them. But also all the time that we're doing that, we're providing that kind of one-to-one support for them as well, whether that's on site here at ARC or whether that's out in the community on the telephone, you know, remotely via Zoom, whatever medium works best.
So just before we go any further, so we've said the armed forces community includes those serving, and in Somerset we've got a 40 commando in Taunton, and we've got HMS Heron near Yeovilton. But wouldn't they have their own doctors and social workers and other support there, or are they able to do that? I ask this because as a GP, if one of my patients joined up, we would lose their records and they're never seen again, even though they may be married and have children and their spouse and children are actually our patients, we would know nothing about them. Mm. So can you just tease out that a little bit, please?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, Nigel and I both worked at Yeovilton in the welfare team there. So, you know, we were part of that very team you're referring to, where we would link in with, you know, the executive on the establishment and the medical side of things, including the mental health teams that were based out of Portsmouth. So the idea of the hubs is to complement that. It's not to take over. And I think there's a huge drive at the moment involving the VCFSE sector in supporting the primary services. So you're right, the military look after their own. We are kind of an addition to that. We may be able to respond faster than that. I mean, my remit is if I have a referral, new referral come in, or an introduction, as I prefer to call them, I'll respond to it within 3 working days, which, you know, for some of the services out there is probably quicker than you can get an appointment with a GP at the moment, or even a referral into through the military psychiatric system to actually speak to somebody. So we can respond quicker. I'm not saying that we'll solve the problem, but we can certainly get in touch and get that ball rolling. And at least at that point, we're holding that person, you know, by talking to somebody and starting something moving, which sometimes is half the battle for someone to feel like they're being effective. Something is happening now. Someone's listened to me and I'm slowly moving forwards.
And just to elaborate on that a little bit, what John said, when we both worked in naval welfare together, we used to work with a serving person, their spouses and their children. So when we worked at Yeovilton, we were always looking for additional services to support the family's needs. So we were having a holistic fix. So it wasn't just about looking at the one issue that's going on for them. It was actually, what else is going on with your life? Can we connect you with other organisations that can support you or help you? Especially when you've got a serving person that's on deployment on a regular basis. The families can be quite of high-end needs because of the loneliness, isolation, the children struggle with issues. So the more organisations we could pull together to work together, the better it was.
And how do the health and care needs of the armed forces community differ from those of the general population? You've touched on isolation, and I imagine moving around is difficult for families and so on. And we all know about PTSD, of course, but what other issues are there?
I think if we start with the very youngest of the family members, you know, for children, it can be relocating schools quite frequently. You know, if they're moving every couple of years to a new school, they lose their friendship groups. If they're moving from one end of the country to another, like you said, isolation and loneliness for families that are kind of move away from their own family support network. But then you also have the other side of that, where a family would choose to stay within their family area, and the serving person is kind of going backwards and forwards. And that has an impact on families as well. I suppose some of the things that mirror problems outside of the military community, things like debt, relationship problems, you know, illness, bereavement, they're kind of common themes all around. I guess when you really kind of focus down on the military side of things, you're right, there's PTSD, you know, and some of the people I'm working with at the moment, they have PTSD from combat. Others have PTSD from non-combat situations. You know, it's kind of life events that have kind of overtaken, or things that they've not had control in or been unable to kind of be effective within. So it's kind of left them dealing with that. So there's a lot that's similar, and there's a lot that is different, I think, and certainly a lot of the veterans that I've spoken to sometimes feel like people on Civvy Street don't understand where they've been and what they've had. And actually, when I've had some conversations with other people and they have been able to open up, they've said it's been nice to talk to another veteran, you know, someone who kind of understands.
Yep. There is another quite unique experience that families get within the military environment, is that because of the regular deployments and the serving person going away for periods of time, then you've got the spouse looking after the family home and the children on their own, becomes essentially a single parent with puts in their own routines, rules and ways of functioning. Then the serving person comes back and expects to slop straight back into their role, into taking over things and stuff. And that can cause a lot of conflict because there's certain things done differently now, yet that person actually wants them done a different way. And we used to have to do quite a lot of work with people just to get to understand that there's a cycle of deployment that goes on, that if you can be open and communicate about it, it can make it easier. But we're only human and we've all got our needs to be met.
So we've just used an acronym two or three, four times, PTSD, which I think stands for post-traumatic stress disorder. But John, would you like to tell us a little bit more about what that is and how it manifests?
Yeah, so what I've seen with the serving people that I've worked with in the past and with the veterans that I'm kind of working with now is that post-traumatic stress disorder has been a response to a situation where their life has been in threat, you know, where they've kind of felt like this is the end, this is happening, you know, and it's, some of it has been, as I said earlier, some of it has been attributable to conflict. Other times it's been situations that are out of control for people. And I guess the kind of difference that what I've seen is with post-traumatic stress from combat, we're talking about things like triggers associated with noises, smells, etc. With regards to people that I'm working with who've got PTSD from life circumstances, it's been more about that lack of control and kind of not knowing what to do, not knowing where to turn, and kind of feeling lost, which again is a huge form of threat to our just general coping strategies. So it's a very broad spectrum, and it's a very delicate area to work within with PTSD.
And the essence of it is that we are having experiences every moment of our lives, and we're processing them and we're completing them. But in the case of PTSD, what happens is we have an experience. The emotion is so intense and overwhelming at the time, and we don't feel safe, that we don't actually get closure at the time. And so classically, we get flashbacks of visions or scenes or sounds or sights that come to mind either when we're relaxed or when there's a trigger. And of course, with our clever human brains, unfortunately, what happens is we start to experience all the emotions again at the same time. So we're actually re-traumatizing when we have those flashbacks to a certain extent. And there are professional ways of coping with this. Medication might or might not be needed sometimes, but I hear there's an organization called Combat Stress. Are they the key people for PTSD, or would you have a number of ways in which you would help people with PTSD? EMDR, another acronym, eye movement desensitization, something or other, whatever.
And reprogramming.
Reprogramming. Yeah. Thank you very much.
And that's a rather weird thing, isn't it? Where you go from left to right and get the eyes to follow. And it somehow seems to integrate the two halves of the brain and help to process emotions in a way I don't think any of us fully understand. But yes, please tell us more.
I did work with a young chap a while ago who presented with a kind of social anxiety style issue. And he ended up talking to me about a situation that had happened when he'd been deployed. And I was starting to think in the back of my head, you know, PTSD here potentially. And I spoke with the psychiatric nurse who was part of the welfare team down at where we were based. And he did two sessions of EMDR with this young chap and turned his life around. And you're right, as you say, it's about lights, it's about tapping, whatever works. But that thing we understand about PTSD is that it's locked in. Your brain doesn't know how to process what's happened. There's no compartment for it. You can't file it away. But EMDR helps the brain to kind of work that out, doesn't it? And of course, there's other ways of working with PTSD, which I'm learning more about as I'm with this. But it's been able to recognize the triggers, and it's been able to kind of come down when there's a trigger occurring. We've just recently had two chaps out here from Service Dogs UK who were explaining to us how they work with a veteran, you know, paired with an animal or paired with a dog that will kind of recognize when they're starting to come up, and they will work with them to break the cycle. So I think one of the examples they were using was that one person would start to pick at their hands when they would start to feel anxious or start to feel like they were going up, I guess. The dog knew that was a trigger and would interrupt it by putting their paws over their hands. So it was kind of breaking that and saying, I'm here, you know, and deflecting it, and it works. So that's a really useful thing, which I've recently learned about in the last couple of weeks. As a way forward of supporting people with PTSD.
They say that part of the process is that we have stuck shock, and in order to process shock, we need a safe place. And a safe place is either a safe relationship, and that would be happening with the dog, or a safe frame of mind, or a safe physical place. You've mentioned here, we're not quite sure where, for our listeners, where here is at the moment. And I think if you'd be kind enough to just tell us a couple of minutes about ARC at Egwood and what you do there, and then we'll come back a bit more to the hub generally, please.
Yeah, certainly. So ARC at Egwood, we opened up our gates in July 2020 with just a field and very little on it. And we just put a shout out on Facebook and to the social work teams, everybody we knew, saying, right, we're here. Who wants to come and what do you want to do? 4 years down the line, we're now supporting people Monday to Friday. On average, we have 40 people a day on site. We've become a safe place for people to come, slow things down, connect with themselves and connect with others. And what we connect people with is nature, animals, horticulture, rural arts and crafts, cooking and other bits of training. And a lot of people say it's their safe space. It's a place where they can just be themselves. They don't have to pretend to fit in. Some people come in and really get stuck in and do stuff. And some people for a period of time, it's the first time they've been out of the house for a long time because they've been socially isolated, anxious. And they just use the space just to really start connecting with something. And when they're ready to connect with other stuff, we connect them with other stuff.
Absolutely fantastic work. And if people are interested in finding out more about ARC, we've done a podcast just on ARC, haven't we? So people can listen into that if they want to. Just coming back to, if I may, just to touch on PTSD for a second, I think it's worth just pointing out to our listeners that this is something that can happen to any member of the population, anyone who's been through a life-threatening event or even a severely traumatizing event. And the treatment that you've talked about in EMDR and talking therapists and so on can be really helpful. So to anyone out there who thinks they might have PTSD, I would encourage them to make an appointment with their GP and discuss it and get some help. Coming back to the armed forces, if I may, is it difficult for people who've been in the armed forces to maybe share their experience and their feelings with somebody who's not been through that? Is there something special about having someone who shared that sort of experience in helping them?
There certainly does seem to be. Just touching one, take one step back to the PTSD, Peter, as John and I have worked with a lot of people in the military or post-military who have got PTSD, but some of these people have had PTSD from their pre-child experiences or pre-military service. Mm-hmm. And there is sometimes a misconception that they've got PTSD because they're in the military, but actually it's not connected to military life. The military life masked that. So we're always mindful that when we work with people, where do you think your PTSD started? And sometimes it's got no connection to the military. The military was a safe space. The experiences for the military was the thing.
I think that's a really important point that you make. And increasingly, we talk about trauma-informed therapy. So we recognize that so many adult mental health problems stem from adverse childhood events. So I think that's a very important point to make. Thank you.
Yeah, and go back to your question. There's a kind of an unspoken rule when a veteran meets another veteran that you've got an automatic connection that you can't put into words. And John and I experience that all the time, and I do if I go to different places, different meetings, seminars. If there's a fellow veteran there, I feel so at ease to open up a conversation and chat to than I would if that person wasn't a veteran. And a lot of people in the military, because they've kind of got a certain mindset, really, because you are kind of trained to be a certain way and think a certain way, it is hard to trust people who you don't think understand where you come from, even though they probably do understand it and they could easily work with you or help you. You sometimes think that they don't understand. So if you go somewhere and present a problem and you don't get listened to straight away, you don't think that person's got it from the outset, then it is easy for a veteran to shut down and think, well, they don't understand me, so what's the point? But when you do connect or go somewhere where the mental health practitioner or the doctor, whatever, has got that military understanding and they get it straight away, then veterans are more keen to open up. Mm. So it is a conversation we have a lot of the time with people that don't not use somebody because they haven't got the military experience. There's people out there that do understand and do get it.
And I guess sometimes we're also looking for, a bit like, you know, as a GP might be looking for physical indicators of something that might allude to a diagnosis, we're almost looking or listening out for audio cues, aren't we? Phrases that people might say, because very often someone won't come back from a tour of, you know, overseas tour where they've seen conflict and, you know, 2 days later come in and say, I've got PTSD. It will be a while down the line, and it's not normally them that notice it. It's normally those closest to them, their family, the children, whatever, may notice that something's changed in their behavior. But then when they used to come in to see us, or when we speak to them now, you know, you're kind of looking out for things, you know, words that they might say. And I guess, you know, it's how we kind of respond to that. And like Nigel said, there's an unwritten rule of it's okay to talk. And actually what we do out here really is promote it's okay not to be okay.
And it's okay not to be okay. And it is okay to talk, but you talked about relationships and the sort of the family sense and the shared level of understanding. And I suppose Peter and I, as having trained as doctors and you've gone through medical training together, there's a sort of an understanding in the things that you can talk about and can't talk about. How about some really distressing things or conflict issues or classified issues? Is it difficult for service personnel to actually talk about something or veterans to talk about something which is secret or could be construed as?
I think, yeah, I mean, everyone that's been in the forces has signed the Official Secrets Act, and we all, you know, that's something that even when you've left, it still kind of applies to you. So, and this is where I was saying about words that we can listen out for, things that we can do, or things that we can hear. You know, you might not necessarily be able to talk specifically about detail, like you said, particularly when it's, you know, if we were supporting someone from the Special Forces, they couldn't tell us what they'd done, but they could tell us that they've seen things and done things. And that's enough, you know, that even that simple phrase in itself is enough to know, you know, I can only imagine what you may have had to go through by what we see in the media and kind of hear about. But they might not be able to go into detail. And I guess sometimes the detail isn't essential. It's more about the kind of working with the presenting feelings, the emotions, the trauma without going down. So, yeah, I guess there is an issue that there are things that we can't talk about. And it's just how we facilitate those conversations, talking about what we can talk about and the language that we can use. And I think, as Nigel said, it's about creating that space where actually we've got the time. There's no rush. If we get halfway through a conversation and you need to stop because it's too much, then we'll stop. If we come back to it in 2 weeks' time, it's about their pace really as well.
And we've concentrated on the problems that veterans and armed forces personnel have, understandably, given the extreme situations that they put themselves in to keep the rest of us safe. But there are positives as well, aren't there? And Nigel, you mentioned that often the army life can be a very positive family, almost wrapping round somebody. And I've certainly got patients who have been in the armed forces who seem to cope with difficulties in a way that just makes me amazed by their courage and bravery. So does the army and the other armed forces also give you those positive coping mechanisms, do you think?
Yeah, I'd say they certainly do. If you take my example, I left school, just gone 16, joined the Navy, didn't have a clue about anything really, except I knew I wanted to be in the Navy, and that was as far as I knew. At each step of my career, the Navy provides training and support, and they build that resilience in you. They give you the way to work through difficult times. They give you all the skills to manage other people and manage situations. So when I left, I felt very fortunate that I had a great plethora of experiences that shaped me into who I was today, really. So, and there's lots of experiences you can do in the forces. It's not just your job, your own job you do. There's other things that offshoot from that you can get involved in that give you resilience and turn you into a kind of strong, robust individual.
Thank you. And thinking about people in the armed forces community, do they have any particular rights or of access and responsibilities that's in terms of health and care that others might not know about?
I mean, one of the things that we obviously enjoyed being in the forces was dentist care, you know, free gym access to your own GPs. What else was there? That's probably it in terms of the kind of healthcare needs. But I think one of the important things that we're trying to, I know the Armed Forces Project Manager, Terry, is kind of, and her colleague, Becca, are kind of educating lots of GPs on being veteran aware or, you know, Armed Forces aware. So when we're talking to veterans here, we're kind of saying, did your GP know that you're a veteran? If not, please do tell them, because under the Armed Forces Covenant, as an identified veteran, if you're in need of a service, you can kind of jump the queue a little bit, but obviously not overtake someone whose needs are greater than yours. But they don't know that, you know, so it's kind of slowly chipping away at the moment, just in terms of education. I know Terry and Becker are doing a lot of that with GPs and the roadshows. And we've got some events coming up, like the Armed Forces Days in Taunton and Bridgewater in the next sort of 4 to 6 weeks, where we're kind of talking that. We're going out and seeing people as well and promoting what we do. And I think, you know, and in terms of the support that's going on out there, I mean, the Hub I've only been here since the end of January. The Hub officially opened on the 13th of March. I've currently got about 16 veterans that I'm working with at the moment and one member of the armed forces. And referrals are coming in every day. I'm getting new ones every day, which is fantastic. So the word is getting out there. But now it's kind of like, so I've done that kind of initial introductory phase, and now it's thinking, where can we go? So who can I signpost people onto? So it's looking at, like I said, making sure that people are veteran aware, signing up for the veteran's ID card. You know, those that left the forces after, I think it was 2018, you know, they were automatically given their veteran's ID card. And some people say, well, what's the point of it? Actually, it's still a bit about belonging. You know, you've talked in here today about the army being, a family, the same around all the armed forces. And actually that little piece of plastic was our connection to that. And when you leave and they cut it in half and kind of march you off the establishment, that's it, the door shut, you're kind of on your own. Or that's what it feels like. So by having access to things like the Hub out here, the Veterans Breakfast Clubs, your armed forces ID card. You know, they're all kind of things that make you still feel part of that community. But then there are the services out there like the NHS provide, UpCourage and UpRestore. You know, so some of the people that I'm working with at the moment, I'm now going to be referring them on to receiving support from there, because it's not within me to kind of provide that when there are services out there. So it's building those networks at the moment and really getting my name and the name of my counterpart at the hub in Taunton well known out there. So one of the things that we will attach, we will send over to you to go out with this podcast, will be the hub poster, which has got my details on and my counterpart Louis' details, you know, so people know how to get hold of us. It's a phone number, it's an email, it's Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. You know, we're not an emergency service, but we are here 9 to 5 for the rest of the time. So I'll make sure that comes across to you to share.
Thank you. It's so great that this is happening. Peter?
I was just wanting to ask, you've given us details of the fantastic work you're doing in Somerset. I presume that this is replicated nationwide, isn't it, in other support for veterans, or isn't it? Where should people who are listening to this, who feel they might need help outside your area, turn to?
I don't think that this is replicated in many other places outside. I think Somerset are kind of leading the way with the Armed Forces Hubs. And that's really through the tenacity of the Armed Forces project manager, Terry, who's kind of done a lot of work in the background to get us to the point where, you know, we had the funding to set up the two hubs. And the plan is that the hubs grow, you know, that we have more hubs around here. I think... Am I right in saying there is another set of, there are hubs in other places, but not necessarily kind of funded quite like the NHS as this is. You know, they're essentially the NHS are paying for me to be here.
Somerset, well, that's good to hear that Somerset is leading the way. And perhaps if people are in other areas listening to this, are inspired to repeat it in other areas, then that would be a very good thing, wouldn't it? Because you're doing a fantastic job.
There are other services around. I mean, as I've been kind of finding my feet here, I've been connecting with other veterans hubs that are kind of around the immediate area, you know, so like in Dorset, down in Devon, etc. But this is the first NHS kind of funded or commissioned hub.
I'd say what's unique about Somerset is this is following on from the memorandum of understanding that happened last year between the ICB, Somerset Council and the voluntary sector. And this is a prime example of how all three can work together to make a big difference and plug the gaps that are being missed at the moment. But there is other things going on in other counties, but not quite exactly how we're doing it here in Somerset.
Very interesting. The answers to so many things are from finding help. And there's that little rhyme that I think we've talked about in the past occasionally, which can be in our minds if we're not careful. You're well until you're ill and see the doctor for a pill. But actually, there are so many other things that are far more important than medication. And having security, having feeling safe, having people who understand, having people who know the way forwards and helping people, helping you navigate through difficulties, and educational aspects about the changes and transitions that happen when you come back from deployment and or go away again are just so valuable for everybody. I don't think people decompress in the same way these days. It used to be many years ago that you would go with your crew or your battalion or whatever to somewhere and all get locked up in a bar for a few hours. And I don't think that's recommended anymore.
Oh, I don't think it is. Just could I just throw one thing into the mix with all the things we're discussing today? So there's been a massive shift in the military and everywhere across the country about it's okay to talk now and people are encouraged to go and seek help. But when John and I were in the military, there was kind of a thing where if you went to get help, if you went to welfare, if you went to charity, it was seen as a bit of a weakness. And there was a period of time where it could affect your career or it went down as a mark against you for promotion. So a lot of us were groomed into the mindset that if you go to welfare, it's a bad thing. Then all of a sudden we get these people leaving the military and they're encouraged to embrace welfare and charity. So we do hear a lot of times say, well, we told them to go and get help from so-and-so and they didn't go and get it. Well, actually, because they've been told that it's not a positive thing, just because they leave on that day doesn't mean the day after it's all positive. You've got to encourage people to change their mindset that these people are there to help you for a reason and they've got funding for a reason to help you. So just embrace it and don't worry what you used to think about in the past.
That's really good to hear. And Andrew, I'm delighted that you raised the issues around things we can do to help ourselves. It's a theme we keep returning to, I know. But I was doing some research for an article looking at the different interventions for depression, and exercise comes number one. It's not just a little add-on that helps some people. It's actually more powerful than taking antidepressants. So getting away from the pill from every ill is absolutely what we want to do. Any last thoughts you want to leave us with?
I just say we're here to be contacted or used by anybody. If anybody's out there that's wondering, should I contact the hub? Should I not contact the hub? Or I've got something going on I'm a bit worried about, but it might not be that relevant. Actually, we're here to, and open to have a conversation with anybody about anything. If you want to find out more about the hub, if you want to find more about ARC or how we can help, then please do get in touch.
Thank you, everybody, very much for coming. Thank you, John. Thank you, Nigel. Thank you, Peter. Armed Forces Hubs in Somerset, a great innovation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Health and Self-Care Podcast. The show was hosted by our team of doctors, including Dr. Andrew Tresidder, Dr. Peter Bagshaw, and Dr. Kate Staveley. The show was produced by David Seeley and Bob Hunt's music.